What's up, knife freaks, sharpness geeks, and purveyors of stabby goodness? Welcome to the Knife Freak Show. My name is Jonathan McNeese. This is my co-host, Mr. Chase Boatwright.
Let's get ready to podcast. Please don't sue us, Michael Buffer.
No, actually, just come on and do the podcast intro for us. That'd be great. Yeah, every time we do one of these intros, we'll see on this one when we play it back. So, guys, we've mentioned multiple times that Chase and I can't see each other while we're doing this. And I always, like, when I say your name, I try to, like, point to you so that, like, it's, like, your square on the screen or whatever. And every freaking time I get it wrong. Like, it's the wrong. I never know which side you're going to pop up on the real video. And I'm like, this is my co-host, Mr. Chase Boatwright. And I point to the left and then you're to the right. And I look like a crazy person. But anyway, I'm just going to start doing it like both sides, like something. I don't know. I'm trying to like Vanna White you, like, you know, here's Chase, and I never know where you're at. So, anyway, so never how's the week in the shop been for you?
Oh, it was great until I ruined two S90V blades. But, yeah, other than that, it was pretty good. Got a folder done, got it shipped out, and started working on the next one and realized that the blade wasn't good. So I immediately, I had a new blade like in the oven in about 4 hours roughly.
Wow.
And, that was surface ground. That was milling. I do like sort of a stop pin track, not like a fully internal stop pin, but I mill a stop pin track now. And, you know, it was all that. And then I somehow screwed that up on the surface grinder after heat treat the next day. So that was great.
Mm.
So I'll be on to the third S90V blade on Monday.
I was going to ask you, if you don't mind sharing, what happened for the on the first one?
The first one, the grind was straight, but it was not centered straight. It was off at an angle.
Been there.
And so it was, I thought it was a centering issue, like for half the time I was working on the knife, like after I ground it, it started having centering issues and I was like, what the hell? And I should have realized then that the grind was off.
Yeah.
And I just kept working on it and kept working on it. And then eventually I like looked at it. I don't know. You can hold it and convince yourself that it looks straight. But I eventually put like a ruler up against it and, you know, or put a flat edge that way I could see where it was going and it was trailing off to one side and that was the side it was off center to. So that made sense.
Yep.
And then
that's frustrating.
I ended up screwing up on the surface grinder because it on the surface grinding attachment, sometimes towards the end of the blade, towards like the pivot and towards the tip, it will kind of dip off. And, you know, basically kind of taper the ends a little bit. And that's not good for, you know, a bearing to be riding on like a tapered surface, you know.
Yeah.
Doesn't keep things square and parallel, so.
Yeah. Whole point of surface grinding is to get it, well, besides to get it down to size, is to get it flat and parallel. So, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That kind of ruined it on that. And I kept chasing it and kept chasing it, and it just kept getting worse. And so I pulled the plug and ordered some more S90V.
So that kind of begs the question to me then, where are you at on getting that big old surface grinder up and running?
Waiting on my buddy to have some time to come over here and help me wire up the other VFD because...
Oh, that's what you fried the VFD on?
Yeah.
Okay, I got you.
I'm still not sure if that bearing, you know, my bearing fix worked actually or not, but...
Right. Yeah,
that's one of the biggest hangups in my shop right now is the surface grinding attachment does work and it can work, but it's not ever going to be as good as a real surface grinder.
Right. Exactly. That's why my brain went straight to that when you said that.
I'm glad that, you know, companies make those for people that don't have enough shop space and, you know, they're, you know, a lot easier to set up and hook up and all that. But again, they're a, you know, facsimile of the real thing. They're not the real thing.
It's a make do if you can't use the real thing, basically. So and it kind of goes with the whole, like, grinders now are like, they have so many cool features and stuff, but you know, you already know this about me, that like I am not a fan typically of multi-task type tools. Like, yeah. I like dedicated tools, because kind of what you're saying, almost every single time, and I'm talking about like hand tools, I'm talking about, you know, power tools, almost every time if you get a tool that supposedly does multiple different things, it yep. very rarely does any of them as good as the tool that actually is supposed to do that thing.
Yep.
And so, yeah, I'm not typically a fan, but there are cases where that's what you need or what you got. You got to, you know, it is what it is. But
yeah.
So, and I believe on your, for the surface grinder, besides the speed control, you need the VFD to be able to, because it's a three phase
yeah.
motor on there, and that converts it to single phase, correct?
Yes.
Okay. Cause I almost asked you, why could you not just straight wire it for now and at least test your bearing out and stuff? But that, then I remembered that it's three phase. So
yeah, we don't all have three phase power.
Well, believe me, I didn't for a long time.
I know.
And wasted a bunch of money and everything else on the, I might as well tell that story real quick. It might yeah. actually help some of you out there that as you're, you know, if there's makers and stuff out there, and as you grow or as you start buying equipment and stuff, you know, you could run into this. And it's, I'm sure it's not the same everywhere, because every person's, you know, utility companies in their area are different, obviously. But so when we built the new shop over here, we, you know, getting hooked up to single phase power was not a big deal. But the, actually back up just a little bit, where I originally was going to build the shop in a slightly different spot. So kind of same area, basically kind of same property, but like on the other side of the road, a little bit farther down. And when the guy from Alabama Power came out here to look at what it was going to take to run, because I was going to have an actual power pole run there. And I was telling him, you know, I really needed three phase power, whatever. And he was looking, and he was like, you know, he just kind of did some little calculations in his head. He's like, yeah, well, you're probably looking at, you know, 30, 40, 50 grand to, you know, to have three phase power run in here, because we'll have to set all these poles and blah, 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 blah. I'm like, you know, and at the time that was, you know, I was like, okay, well, that's not something we can do. So I definitely can't afford that. So we just went with the, and even though we ended up building the shop somewhere that we didn't have to have a pole set for just single phase power. So we went ahead, but I already had that in my head that it was going to cost, you know, $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 to have it put in. So we just went ahead, put in single phase power, and I bought a phase converter. I think it was like $7,000 or $8,000 yeah. To be able to run the first CNC when we got it. And so it worked. It worked fine. It was noisy, and it was made the room that the big motor, giant motor was in, extremely hot. But yeah. But it worked. So
Got
had a built-in sauna. But anyway, so then comes time to buy. Actually, I ended up getting the next two machines at the same time.
Yeah,
I just pulled the trigger on another new Oz, and then at the same time, somebody hit me up with a used one for sale, and I decided to go ahead and get it too. And they literally got delivered on the same day. So anyway, so we went from needing power to one machine to three machines, and I was like, the choice was laid out to me to either, you know, get two more phase converters or whatever, and keep trying to add phase converters, which was going to get complicated from what I understood. So I got serious at that point. I was like, all right, well, let me just find out exactly what it actually would cost to get the power company to put three phase power in here. So after a bunch of back and forth, I finally got them to do it. And when it all came down to it, what they ended up doing is they it's not prorating. They give you a certain amount. They have a formula where they estimate how much power you're going to be using in a year. And they, if they're going to do a job like to bring power to your shop or whatever, they take how much you're going to make a year. And then they have a formula that adds up, you know, they'll do like up to three times that amount worth of work or something like that to, you know, so in other words, if you're going to have $10,000 worth of power for the year, then they'll do a job up to like $30,000 on an install without it costing you anything or something like that. So anyway, all came down to, is all said and done, I got three phase power running here, and I think it cost me like $1,500. something like that. So way less than the phase converter cost in the first place. I would like to save money to have real three-phase power running here right off the bat and not had to, you know, and now I've got phase converter sitting around that I don't use that I really need to sell. So anyway, so if any of you out there ever get to the point where you need three-phase power before you think it's not an option, by all means, get your power company, the utility company to get nail them down and get them to give you an answer. So
yeah.
Anyway.
A real quote, like, yeah.
A real quote, right. Not just some engineer out there talking and running his mouth, because, like I said, there was a huge difference between what, you know, $50,000 he was saying and $1,500 that it ended up costing me. So,
yep, for sure.
But anyway,
I forgot where we were going after that, or where we were.
It's fine. You were just talking about what was going on in the shop, and but I think we have, we had a, let's see, what did we say? We're going to start with a question.
Yeah, but I did want to remind everybody that Blade Show West is coming up soon, and about all that, and that, you know, y'all will be there. I will not be there. It's out in Utah, y'all.
Yeah,
pumping along in the shop. I'm assuming.
Yeah, yeah, we are. Honestly, we're just kind of we've been so intent on getting Dixons out there in the wild so they can, you know, start to get into more hands and let people see what they're all about and stuff, that we really haven't done a lot of planning or putting anything back yet for the show, but it's okay. Yeah. We've got time to do, you know, what we need to do. I'm going to try to come up with probably a couple of kind of special ones for the show. And, I don't know how crazy we're going to get, but at least something a little bit special. And then we are going to have quite a few of the base models and stuff. I don't know that we're going to have, we may have a few, just a handful of random 3.5s Mac 2s, but we're getting really low on those and parts on those. So those are going to be pretty thin. Probably it's going to be mostly Dixons at the show. Probably, like I said, have just a few of those and a few Automax. And I'm really hoping to have some fixed blades at the show, at least a handful, but we'll see. I'm currently trying to figure out the grinding on them. They're being a little bit of a pain, but I think I've just about narrowed down what the problem is. So we're working on it.
Gotcha.
But once I get the grinding kind of figured out on them, like, we're gonna got two or three or even four models that I really of fixed blades that I want to, and a couple more that are still in my head that won't take long to bring to fruition if I can get the grinding part figured out. Yeah. So really looking to make a big push into the fixed blade market here the second half of the year, or second half. We're moving right on along here.
Yeah, but I do the same thing. I'm like, oh crap, it's already August. When did that happen? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Of course, I've been saying the same thing, I think, for the last 2 years. So I think it's like the third year I've been saying, oh, by the end of the year, we're going to have a good fixed blade line. But the blade grinding has been the main thing that's held us up this whole time. So if I can get that nailed down, I think we really will be able to actually make it happen. So anyway.
Sweet.
But yeah. We'll be fine for the show. We don't take just tons and tons of stuff to that show, but we take plenty. But
yeah,
that's the one show that we have to fly to out of all the shows that we do currently.
Yeah.
So there's the fun with that. But
yeah, that kind of limits, you know, in some ways what you can bring and how much and all that. So
it definitely makes it more challenging for sure, especially since it's just me and Amy that are going. So it's not, we don't have a team going with us or whatever. So,
yeah. But
it's the way we set our booth up there actually is pretty simple too, though. We basically just use the big fabric, you know, banner in the back that's lightweight and folds up pretty small. And then we use tablecloths and, just rent the tables or whatever and have from them and have table. So we basically just have to take like tablecloths and big fabric banner. And that's pretty much it, other than just small odds and ends. And then the knives, of course.
Yeah.
And I'm going to remember not to mess up this year. Last year, I tell you, I've got like, I forget what number Pelican case it is, but it's one of the big Pelican cases. And I packed all the knives in it. And I was like, all right, they're all in there together. I locked them up. I put air tags in there with it, the whole works, like to try to minimize security issues or whatever.
Yeah.
But then we get to the airport and I pull that big old sucker up on the scale and they're like, oh, this is overweight. Like, crap. It was fine, but we had to pay like, I don't know, it was like an extra $100 and something, I think, to check it. But the kicker was that we were flying Southwest, so we could check bags, more than one bag. I think you could check like two bags a piece for free or whatever. So all I had to do is spread them out into two cases and I would have been fine.
Yeah.
But I probably literally could have put like, you know, 10 knives in a different case and not been over the weight limit on the other case. But anyway, lesson learned. So I'll do it a little different this year. But yeah, the fun of traveling with cargo for a show.
Yeah, for sure. That's sounds terrifying to me, but just.
Yeah. Well, the terrifying part is worrying about getting there and something. I mean, we all know that losing your luggage or your luggage getting delayed at least is not uncommon with airlines. And that I'm like, please don't let that.
Please, I mean, that happened to the Grimsmo's at Blade Show this year. Like they.
Yeah. I think it's happened. I think that's the second time it's happened, honestly.
I think so.
I think and the first time they ended up getting them before the show was over, and this time I don't think they got them at all.
No, he ended up getting them, like, I think he said it was 6 weeks later or something like that. Yeah. He recently posted that he flew back down to Atlanta. All the knives were there. Everything was fine. They were just lost for 6 weeks.
That's ridiculous.
Yeah.
But, of course, they're dealing with the extra of coming cross borders, so that's, that makes it way worse, I'm sure. But No, that's a nightmare. Uh-oh. Technical difficulties. Forgot I had my microphone on my hat here.
We did have a good question that came up on the last video on YouTube from Chris Jarrett 4974. I think that was the right number thing for his username and whatnot. But so thank you, Chris, for the question. And he said, I love the show, so please keep it up. I don't have a specific guest I would like to see, but I do have a question I would love your input on. I'm a knife enthusiast, and I only do light tasks for my EDC. My Dixon is more knife than I will ever need for my day-to-day applications. I was at Blade Show, and I saw a smaller, lesser-known maker selling a knife in 154. He says 154 CPM, so I don't know if he means CPM 154 or 154 CM, but either way, in 154 CM for around $800. It made me wonder, are my expectations skewed by influencers who put a lot of emphasis on steel type, or is the difference in steel performance often minimal compared to the impact of craftsmanship, design, and the maker's skill?
Yeah, so that is a good question. You want to do first, or you want me to?
I'll start off, I guess.
All right.
Considering, you know, I would be in that price bracket, and I have no problem using CPM 154 on a folder, or, you know, I use 154 CM on my fixed blades. And I don't even really see a problem. They're the same identical chemistry. I mean, I would generally go up to the CPM just because it's, you know, on paper, it's a better idea, more refined, you know, steel.
Right.
But, and, you know, I know you used a lot of CPM 154, but I have, you know, in the custom realm versus the production realm, definitely I would say that you're looking, the sum of the materials is not necessarily the same as the price tag of the materials as much as it is in the custom world. You know, if I make a knife out of 154 CM and titanium you know, Michael Walker makes a knife out of 154 CM and titanium, they're going to sell at two different prices, you know, on that basis alone. But also on the influencer side of things, yes, influencers definitely put way too much emphasis on steel type, and they kind of always have. It's always been sort of, you know, pushing for more and only wanting to have what's, you know, best on paper, even if, you know, all they do is cut tape on, you know, new knife boxes and stuff like that. And I understand that. I get that point. But CPM 154 is a very well-rounded steel, very good steel. and there's nothing wrong with it at all. And when you're, you know, looking at all these different steels, it's not necessarily what's best, it's what suits you best in a lot of ways, or what you like most. Because once you get to a certain point in the steel hierarchy, I think you reach a point of diminishing returns where you're paying for performance that you don't need. It's like getting a Hellcat for getting groceries, basically. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, very, very similar to what you're saying. And we've touched on stuff that, you know, pertains to this in a few different times. One being the, you know, the fact that no one steel or no one knife even is necessarily going to be the right tool for the job for every task. So it goes back to what you just said, that it depends on what you're going to use it for, that kind of stuff. You know, if you're just doing normal everyday cutting tasks, which like I said, I think the original question was basically just, you know, just general EDC knife. But, you know, even that, a general EDC knife to somebody that works in an office and, you know, and I'm not knocking anybody one way or the other, but just like somebody that say that works in an office, maybe doesn't have a lot of outdoor hobbies or whatever, you know, they're just kind of a, you know, general dude, is probably going to be different requirements for somebody that works a, you know, really blue collar job in construction or, you know, at a mill or whatever, or, you know, and or has, you know, lots of, you know, outdoor hobbies and stuff, like, you know, whether you're out doing camping and bushcrafting and that kind of stuff, or hunting and fishing. And like, I mean, there's, you know, whether you're cleaning game with stuff, or, you know, there's a lot of, you know, or somebody that works on a farm. I mean, there's a different people's lifestyle dictates a lot of, you know, what a good EDC carry would be for them. Because, you know, I mean, hell, for some people, you know, an EDC carry might include a tomahawk or a, you know, a hatchet or whatever, you know, guys out here doing, you know, fire jumpers and stuff, like have a whole lot different need than somebody that's, you know, clocking in and out at the local, you know, at the local office building down here. So, you know, again, depending on what you're doing on your free time and stuff like that, you know, somebody that's going scuba diving is going to have different needs than somebody that's, you know, in a really that's using a knife in the desert. Like, so lots of variety there as far as what's the best. So I totally agree with Chase that, like, yes, the influencers in general, not that they're wrong about the properties of the steel necessarily, but as far as how it actually affects what you need or what's better, you know, being a complete snob about it to the point where you're writing off a knife just because it has a, you know, what's being considered a lesser steel is kind of ridiculous, honestly. It's just, that's all, you know, social media driven, you know, whatever. Not hysteria, but, you know, whatever. It's social media driven behavior. Yeah. So it's, you know, because again, there's been, you could argue that people have probably, especially at least for like a lot of people in the EDC community, there are probably, you know, people now are probably not using knives as hard as people, you know, did, you know, 50 years ago when most of these steels didn't exist and those people were getting by really well with the steels that they had. You know what I mean? Like, they're not that it couldn't have been better, and we have made, you know, great improvements, but it's just, a lot of it just comes down to talking points. Like, it's kind of like you said, you know, it's at some point it's overkill, and, you know, you've got your four, like you said, a Hellcat, or like you've got your big outdoor, you know, I think a good example of it would be the, in the Jeep world, there's, you know, the mall crawlers that people like to call it. You know, they're all built up for off-road stuff, but then they never actually go off-road. And again, I'm not knocking it because they look cool as hell. Like, I mean, no. I don't care if you're taking it off-road or not. I mean, if I see a good looking Jeep, I'm going to admire it either way, but to worry about that, you got exactly the, the best transmission, that you've got exactly the right gear ratio, that you've got the right suspension, that you've got all that, when you're literally never getting off the pavement, is all just kind of, you know, it's kind of crazy, you know?
Yeah. And but, to be clear, like, I mean, I don't think it's a bad thing to have more steel, you know, more edge performance than you need, or I don't think it's a bad thing that we have, you know, all the great, you know, steels that we have. But you just, you know, you kind of have to be honest with yourself of whether, you know, do you actually need that? And also, do you like the knife enough to, you know, if you are, you know, more in the knife steel nerd sort of camp, like if you are sort of, you know, a steel snob in some way, do you know, do you like the knife enough to overcome it, not having your favorite steel or what you perceive to be the best steel? That's all, it's all a matter of preference. And if you don't like it enough, you don't buy the knife. It's not, you know, it's all down to personal preference and what you like. That's all this really is, you know,
right.
Do I need 120 knives sitting by my bedside table? Probably not, but I like it, so I do it.
Yeah. Well, and I think a lot of people too, I think it causes people to miss out on really good knives that they would really like and really enjoy. Yes. And they kind of turn their nose up at them just because it has a steel that, you know, 5 or 10 years ago was considered top of the line super steel, but now because something else came along, that steel's being looked at as, you know, I'm sorry, but you know, a whatever, I keep going back to the car stuff, but like, you know, a McLaren from 10 years ago isn't a piece of crap because it's 10 years old, you know? Yeah. I mean, it's still a McLaren. Like,
yeah.
It's you gotta keep this stuff in perspective, and like I said, you're definitely not. And what really bugs me is when people get on this kick of like almost trashing out the maker or the company, because the same thing happens with, you know, in the, on the production side too. Yeah. But yeah, but like turning your nose up or even like trashing out a company or a maker because they're using some steel that's not what you consider the top of the line steel. Like that's just, it's a little ridiculous, honestly.
Yeah. Yeah.
But, for sure. The other thing that you need to consider is the steel itself, the composition of the steel is only one factor in how that knife is going to perform. So even if you're actually worried about the actual performance of the knife,
yeah, there's, and it's the least important factors of the factors.
Right. Exactly. It's like the blade grind, the, you know, how the edge is done, the sharpness of it, the heat treat on that steel, because just because something is marked, you know, MagnaCut or CPM 154 or whatever, those are not all exactly the same from one, you know, one maker or one company to the other. Like the heat treat, all that plays a lot on it. And you could have the best heat treated knife on the best heat treated steel out there, and if the thing is, if it's made like, you know, say a steel that takes a really good edge and keeps an edge a long time, well, say it's heat treated to the absolute max, it's the best heat treat it can have on it, it's the best steel that we got, can get our hands on, but then the blade is made like a freaking splitting wedge and it's got a crappy, you know, thick edge on it,
yeah,
it may get sharp, but it's not going to stay sharp and it's not going to slice. Like all day long, give me a knife made out of 1095 with a good edge geometry and a good heat treat on it over a crappy one that's made out of, you know, MagnaCut that has a great heat treat, but crappy grinds and crappy edge geometry. Like, yeah, there's so many different factors that factor in, mainly being the heat treat and the edge geometry, that, you know, there's more things to worry about than just the name of the steel. And people get hung up on that. And
yeah,
I
get it in some way. 'Cause I mean, like in the production world, that is very much, you know, there's sort of a ladder that gets climbed, I guess, as if climbed is a word. You know, you go from the 8CR 13 MOVs and the, you know, plastic handles to D2 and G10 to, you know, 154 CM, and then, you know, you get up into the S30Vs and the S35VNs and up to 20CV and MagnaCut, and like it sort of is a ladder like that in the full production world, not talking about small batch, you know, sort of stuff, but it's sort of like what you can expect for the price point, but also that's, you know, not always indicative of what is best either.
Well, and I would actually go so far as to say that a lot of times that as you kind of go up that hierarchy and you expect, you know, as a company puts out knives that are higher priced, they have the more premium steels on them, that it's not just because that company necessarily thinks that that steel is that much better. It's just that they know that people aren't going to buy it if it doesn't have those steels in there, yeah. You know? So it's not necessarily that, you know, but it gives the perception that if it's not that steel, that it's not, you know, that their premium line needs to have these steels in it or else it's not considered premium. But,
yeah.
You know, it's kind of a self-perpetuating thing that, you know, sure, if everything else being equal, you give me good blade grinds, good edge geometry, good heat treat, and then a premium knife steel, yes, I'll take that all day long over all those same factors and a less premium steel. Again, depending on what you want to use it for, you know, that it kind of all just depends. Yeah. So, yeah. But yeah, I think that honestly, it's kind of gotten a little bit more out of hand. Social media has definitely affected that. People, I don't think this used to be quite as bad back in the days, like when it was the forums and stuff. Like there was some steel snobbery going on or whatever, but like you could still sell. I mean, I sold knives and, you know, CPM 154 had been around a while, but it was still considered a good, it's not like it was a bargain basement steel. Good steel. It had been a solid steel for a long time. And so, you know, I used a crap ton of that. I've got kitchen knives at the house that I might have, which at the time, I don't think very many people were making kitchen knives out of CPM 154, but yeah. Like they've held up great. Like they work fantastic.
Yeah. So, CPM 154 is one of those very versatile steels that I would be fine making a kitchen knife and I would be fine making a chopper out of it. It's a very,
yep.
You know, right. Versatile steel like that.
Right. And so it's just, you know, but then I've also taken 1095 that I've heat treated and beat the ever living crap out of it, you know,
yep.
All the way back to some of my very first YouTube videos way back then when I was hammering one through the lid of a dryer and everything else. Like,
I need to link that.
Yeah. Yeah. it's crazy how good of a performance you can get out of some of this stuff if you know what you're doing and you're like, again, you get all the factors to include the geometry, the heat treat, you know, and all that combined with the type of steel, you know,
yeah.
Then, you know, a lot of people now, I think kind of, as we talked about the other day, a little bit about the disposable world that we live in. I think yeah. People have also gotten really used to, they want as low maintenance as possible,
mm-hmm.
You know? So like, even very though nice. There's some really good steels out there that are not stainless, like they, in not in all circles, so still in some of the circles, like I said, Bushcraft and some of these circles, that stuff, a lot of that's still really popular. But
yeah.
In a lot of the other, and more in like the EDC world, it's like those steels get their nose turned up at, but like they're still really good steels. And there's nothing that says that you shouldn't have to maintain your stuff, you know? Like I, back to the McLaren a minute ago, I mean, you're still going to want to keep the oil changed in it. You're still going to want to, you know, keep it washed and keep a wax job on it, protect the paint. Like, you know what I mean? Like it's, there's always going to be a certain amount of maintenance that needs to be done. But I think that as we've moved into more, you know, disposable and we want it disposable, we want it maintenance free. We don't have to fool with it. You know, we just want it perfect all the time without doing anything to it. And that's not really achievable. You know, I mean, you can cut down on the maintenance and stuff, but anyway, I think all those are factors in why we've gotten so hung up on the names of the steels and stuff, you know, versus how they actually perform.
Go ahead.
I don't know how you would do it. I would love to set up a blind testing sometime and send out some knives that are, you know, the customers don't know what steel they are and let them, you know, rate the performance and stuff. And then, you know, then record what the steels actually were and what they rated the performance or whatever and see if it actually held up. So in other words, they, you know, 10 people got MagnaCut and 10 people got, you know, CPM 154, let them use them for a month or whatever. And then see if the ratings on them for their performance were, you know, in theory, based on everything that everybody talks about, all these influencers to talk about, then the ratings for the 150 CPM 154 should average considerably lower than for the Magna Cut, right? I mean, yeah. Based on, right. So I would like to do a blind thing and see if that actually panned out. And it might, I don't know, but I don't think it would.
Yeah, I don't
think
either.
I think you would find people would convince themselves that, oh, I got the Magna Cut. Or you could just tell them, not tell them what steel it is. I don't know what the best way to do it would be to either,
yeah, you know,
just totally blind, or be like, all right, you've either got Magna Cut or you've got CPM 154.
Yeah.
And just see. Because I'd be cool to do it both ways, because I think yeah, that would skew it. I think people would convince themselves, oh, this has got to be the Magna Cut, and then they'd rate it good versus, you know, or the other way around. Like, oh, I think this one's CPM 154. I better, you know.
Yeah, and we would have to get, like, what they thought, you know, it was, and then compare it to what the thing actually is.
Right.
That would be an interesting little project. I just don't know how to actually do that. But, yeah.
Yeah.
Chris, that was, I mean, that is a very good detailed, question. You know, very nuanced question. But, yeah, we do appreciate it. And hopefully we answered it in some sort of capacity. But, yeah, especially when you're getting up into the, I would say, the higher end or the custom market, you know, you're definitely looking at more other factors, I would say, than just the, you know, alphanumeric code that's stamped on the side of the blade.
Yeah. So. Yeah. Make sure that, and again, it also goes back to, you know, there's even a difference. Well, no, it's probably more magnified with custom makers, but, you know, we've kind of talked about before too, with some of the stuff that, like, a certain amount of what you're paying for is the brand or the maker's reputation and stuff as well.
Yeah.
So, like, you know, that stuff factors in, you know, it's whether we want to think it does or not, it does factor in. So
yeah, I mean,
that goes into it too.
There's certain makers. I mean, like, right off the top of my head, I think of Bob Dozier. I don't want a Bob Dozier knife in Magna Cut. I want a Bob Dozier knife in D2.
Yeah. So that's what he's known for. Yeah.
Yeah.
And also, like you said, somebody like Michael Walker or somebody like that, I don't give a crap. Like, make it in freaking, you know, whatever. I don't care.
Yeah.
You know, I'd still like to have it regardless. You know what I mean? Like, it doesn't need to be a premium steel by any means. And he's still going to be able to demand, you know, top dollar prices. So
yeah, you can make a simple folder out of 1084 and I'd be all about it. You know,
that's right. So lots of factors there, but bottom line, yes, I think it's overblown by the influencers and stuff. And just, you know, the best thing you can do is try different stuff and see what you like, you know, and you may find that one particular steel works for you. You also may find that you get a knife in the same steel from two or three different makers or companies, and none of them perform the same.
Yep.
Because, like we said, there's a lot of other factors that factor in. So that's more likely what you will find. But anyway, but yeah, great question.
All right. So moving on to a little bit of levity after that, we had a knife story sent in by one Mr. John Bidwell. I believe you were going to do us a dramatic reading of that.
We'll see. I don't know how dramatic, but I mainly wanted to read it because I can totally relate, because me and John are basically about the same age. So, I can totally relate with this story. Some of it, I'm going to have to question a little bit of it here, but anyway, so yes, we asked for you guys' knife stories. And so we've got one for you here. So I'm going to read Mr. John Bidwell's email. And John, thank you for sending this in. Somebody had to go first. Now, the rest of you guys need to quit being shy and send us some stories. So, he says, "What's up, knife freaks? Okay, here's my story. This is way back olden days stuff." Well, I'm reading it, so no, it's not. It wasn't that long ago. Us old guys got to stick together. All right, I know I was a first grader, but the year is a little fuzzed out, 77 to 79 approximately. Again, first grade. It's Christmas morning, sometime in between 77 and 79. And I remember getting my first old-timer pocket knife. We did a lot of stuff outdoors, hiking to lakes, camping, fishing, typical Oregonian outdoor stuff with your family. And I got my very first pocket knife in first grade on Christmas. Notice he wasn't worried about what steel it was. back to the last question. All right. I was so excited. So then my last gift is I remember being so excited because I got a Stretch Armstrong, the Green Monster or something. Not sure 100%, but it was Stretch Armstrong's enemy, and he was Swamp Thing green, and I loved it. And I'm with you. I do not remember. He sent us a picture of it, and maybe you can link that, Chase.
Yeah.
I do not remember his name either, John, but I 100% remember this character. I don't think I ever had. Actually, I may have. I don't remember for sure. Anyway, it's cool. If you guys don't know what Stretch Armstrong is, you just need to look it up and see, because it was cool as crap. And especially if you're a destructive young man like I am, and sounds like John definitely was. Lets you work out some of your destructive stuff without actually tearing stuff up in most cases. John's excluded. So he got the Swamp Green Monster, loves it. So the next morning he's sitting in his bedroom with all the new toys, and he got the pocket knife and probably some socks and underwear, typical Christmas stuff back then. I'm opening that two blade old timer thinking it's so cool. I can carve, I can whittle, I can trim everything, cut everything. Didn't matter. I just needed something to cut. So then the monster is getting stretched aggressively, which is the whole deal with the Stretch Armstrong. Like, you could stand on one hand, one arm of it, and stretch the other one out. Like, you could stretch those things like, seem like 2 feet.
Yeah.
And actually that's exactly what he said. It was so cool to stand on one arm and pull the other, and it didn't break. But then his invasive thoughts got to him. Because he says, then the crafty outdoorsman in me thought. I don't think it was the crafty outdoorsman, John. I think it was the destructive kiddo, but that's all right. What's inside of this thing? Yep. Next thing you know, old man walks in asking, how many pancakes do I want? 10 minutes later, I'm getting the paddling of my ass, paddled ass of a lifetime for messing around and cutting the toy from snooter to tooter, then had the knife taken away from me. So
snooter to tooter.
Snooter to tooter. He cut her open. Had to see what was inside. I'm thinking probably not realizing that that would be the end of said toy, but you know, hopefully some reasoning thinking got a little better down the line. Finally got another old timer the following year from good old grandpa, but the toy is gone forever. All right, so then, though, so, okay, that sounds like some pretty typical kid with a knife and a toy stuff. I'm at least glad it didn't involve any blood, at least any of yours.
Yeah.
Because then he goes on with a follow-up to say, and this is where I got to start to question Mr. John Bidwell just a little bit. I'm really hoping he's grown out of this decision making here. So also, if I did not mention in that email, when I cut it open, it was purple and it tasted sweet like sugar. It was syrupy. So it says that in some info, but I actually tasted it off the old timer blade. So either Mr. John Bidwell is a bit of a psychopath and the kind that would, you know, stab somebody or cut somebody and then lick the blood off the knife.
Yeah.
Or he just had some really bad impulse control as a kid and he thought it looked sweet and syrupy, and so he had to give her a taste. So
I wonder what's inside. I wonder what it tastes like. I mean,
that's a little bit of a stretch for me, pun intended there. I can see the cutting it open thing, but the tasting it, that's got me a little bit worried there, John. But I believe you probably turned out okay. You seem like a pretty good dude now, so apparently it didn't hurt you. And I'm sure it was probably non-toxic being a toy, especially back in those days. Like, they, you know.
Yeah, I'm sure.
They knew somebody was going to be eating that, you know. It also kind of made me wonder why.
Person. Does he have three eyes or?
I have not met John in person yet to see if he has three eyes.
Okay.
We maybe, hopefully not, but I kind of made me wonder if maybe he missed his calling, why he didn't go in the Marine Corps, because that sounds exactly like, you know, that eating crayons, you know, that kind of stuff. That seems exactly like you were probably Marine Corps material, John. But so Highly do not recommend probably cutting open your brand new toy. I definitely don't highly recommend tasting whatever's inside of it. But
yeah.
Apparently he got away with it other than having a paddled ass. So
makes for a good story at the very least.
Yeah, and missing the and no more stretch. So it sounds like he got to stretch on him for about a day and then decided to go Dr. Frankenstein on him and there we go. So
that does actually remind me of a similar-ish story that of my youth of playing with knives and stuff. I was messing around with my knife, like digging in the dirt or doing something dumb one day down in, we had a little shed where my dad kept his bass boat, and there was some old spray paint cans laying around, and, you know, shaking them around and thinking, I wonder what's in there, and I wonder if I can get it out. And I basically did that. Took my little, it was a stag for fake stag with a little like brass S guard, real swoopy upswept blade sort of knife, and stabbed it in the paint can that turned out to be pink spray paint. And I found out there was a marble inside, but there's still pink spray paint on that knife today.
I thought it was headed towards ending up on the boat.
No,
get spray paint on the boat. Okay.
No, I was smart enough to go around like to the other side. There was something in between. There was like the boat in one bay, and then there was like some plywood and stuff set up on one of the poles on the other side. And I was smart enough to go over there and do it there. I don't think I ended up getting in trouble for it at all. I just, you know, ended up with pink spray paint all over me, my knife.
So you got the marble
cousin,
out of it.
Who is a Marine. Yeah. The Marine tendencies is what made me think of that, because my cousin was there and he's in the Marines now. So,
yeah, he might have been egging you on a little bit.
Yeah, probably. We tended to do that. So,
yeah, that's. I'm sure that I did some dumb stuff like that when I was a kid too. Nothing's ringing a bell. I know we had to take our son's knife. Actually, we took like all his knives away from him at this point. He was well old enough to know better. Some point we went in there, and so the bedroom furniture in his room was like bedroom furniture that had been in the family for, I don't know if it was Amy's or her brother's or somebody. It was passed down furniture that, you know,
yeah.
It wasn't like super fancy or anything, but it was intended to stay in the family, you know.
Yeah,
and we go in there one day, and he's been carving in the headboard of it with a knife for no apparent reason. So yeah, that led to a confiscation for I think a few weeks of all of his sharp objects and everything else. I think he even had some nunchucks that we took away or something too. Like everything that along that line got confiscated for a little bit. So
yeah.
Anyway, yeah. Well, I'm glad you survived, John. That was that could have been a tale we never heard if they hadn't had enough foresight to put non-toxic jelly syrup in the Stretch Armstrong.
Yeah, I mean, I'm hoping that's why it was sweet, and you know they knew somebody was going to do it, but
I'm quite sure.
Yeah.
Okay, so yeah, that's a good one, John. Guys, please. Surely some other guys out there, some of you got some other stories for us. So
some taste.
Don't be shy. John has shared, and if he shared eating the goo, then I surely y'all can share yours.
Yes. So in preparation for potentially interviewing other people, Jonathan had the idea of possibly swapping some interview-esque questions between us back and forth, stuff we've never directly asked each other and stuff like that, so we can kind of again practice for that, but also share some, you know, sort of insight to ourselves and our businesses and, you know, that sort of stuff with you guys as well.
Yeah.
So you want to lead off?
Sure. And so like you said, we're going to practice because we are working, guys, on trying to get some guests lined up. So hang in there for that, and I think that's going to be a lot of fun if we can get it all logistically lined up. So, yes, to practice, let's start with Chase here, and let's see. So what I wanted to know first, pretty basic, kind of generic, but where do you see your business, you know, you, your business, whatever, in 5 years?
Well, hopefully making more knives than I am now. in a long way around a short conversation, I don't know what that looks like at the current moment. I'm very heavily looking at a CNC right now, looking at power requirements and where I'm going to put the thing and all that sort of stuff. But regardless of whether I do that or if I know a couple people with CNCs in the U.S. that, you know, be willing to make parts for me and, you know, be able to do sort of a mid-tech type of thing. I mainly just want to be able to make more knives and have more availability and, you know, put more stuff out there so more people can experience it.
Right.
But as far as so, grand master plan, I am not necessarily a good evil villain in that sense. I don't tend to do good long-term plans like that.
Well, to be honest with you, a general idea of a plan and a direction is basically about the best you can do anyway, because
yeah.
I guarantee you anybody that does a, you know, especially for a length of time like 5 years, if you try to do an actual super detailed plan, it's going to change like a lot.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, but at the same time, you don't, and I'm not saying this to you. I mean, I'm saying you in general, the people doing anything like this, like you also don't want to, you don't want to not think about it and not kind of formulate at least a rough plan.
Yes.
You know, you don't want to use that as a crutch to be like, oh, well, it's going to change anyway, so I'll just wing it and see where we go. Cause you definitely need to have a direction in mind. Cause
I saw, Clay and Courtney of E-Knives post something shortly after Blade Show. They did what they called a vision day, basically trying to map out the next, you know, 4 or 5, 10 years of their business and that sort of thing. And that's something I've been meaning to sit down and do, like me and my wife sit down and, you know, actually get a rough plan together, not entirely step by step down to the nano level, you know, sort of thing.
Right.
But, you know, a rough step of try to hit these goals on this timeline and, you know, move forward with that.
Well, yeah. And then you know, if you kind of know where you want to go, then you're basically trying to reverse engineer it of how to get there.
Yeah.
Like that's basically the idea, is know where you want to go, because you got to know where you want to go in the first place or you ain't going to get there. Just like when you get in a car, like you can't just, you know, randomly start driving and end up somewhere that you want to be or whatever. I mean, that's, if you have somewhere that you want to be, you've got to know where that place is. Yeah. But anyway, so yeah, that's, so do you, a couple of little follow-up questions then, do you foresee, this could push past the 5-year mark potentially, but you know, at some point, even with a CNC, even if you end up with a couple of CNCs, you're going to reach a point where manpower is going to limit how much you can do, you know, even if you got a CNC making parts or whatever, like somebody's still got to run the CNC. You've got to program it. You've got to, you know, you got to do all the CAD and CAM work. You've got to run it. You've got to swap parts out. And like I said, if you get, just start adding CNCs, well, then you end up spending more time loading and unloading CNCs than you do putting knives together and so on.
Making
so forth.
Parts
so,
instead of making knives.
I know you know all these things from just in general, but also having lived it in our shop. So, do you foresee for now, at least just trying to maximize what you can do as a one man show?
Yeah, for now. And probably for the next 5 years, depending on how, you know, far that goes. I mean, like you've been talking about the past few weeks, you know, you'll get to the point where you reach and you see bottlenecks and where things need to change and be filled in. And you know, at this point I need more parts. I spend most of my time making folder parts instead of making knives. I feel like more time, you know, like I said, you know, I cut out a blade, I ground the profile, I drilled the hole, or, you know, I ground the profile, I surface ground it, I drilled the holes, I milled the stop pin track, I heat treated it, and it's all for nothing basically at this point. Since I ruined it, but, and you know, I know ruining things still happens. There's no
perfect word. Unfortunately, yeah. Well, it depending on how you do it. I mean, the way we're doing it, we're trying to do, I mean, because you can run one knife at a time, one knife worth of parts at a time on a CNC. There's nothing that says you have to run, you know, a whole pallet full of parts or whatever.
Yeah.
But yeah, the way we do it, typically, if I don't usually just mess up one, it's usually multiples because it's a whole pallet of them or whatever. But yeah, you already know way too
There's another maker here in Alabama, Ware Knives, Matthew Warewine, that's about an hour or so east of me. And he recently got a CNC about a year ago, and he's been sort of doing this transition. Instead of full handmade, now he, you know, cuts blades and handle scales and stuff and does all the milling and drilling on the CNC and then hand grinds it, you know, hand grinds the blade still and then does all his finishing techniques that, you know, he does. But he's able to pump out more due to having more good parts available.
Oh, yeah.
You know, having more consistent parts available.
Right. You get rid of a lot of the kind of mundane and in some ways lesser skill level required tasks and stuff. I mean, you have to have a certain amount of skill. I mean, not just anybody, most anybody off the street can't just walk into a grinder and put a clean profile on a part or drill holes accurately or whatever. But at the same time, it doesn't take usually a whole lot of time to be able to do those things.
Yeah.
But now you start getting into the knowledge of how to fit up the lock, fit up the detent, grind the blades, you know, all that kind of stuff. You're getting into the higher level skill stuff. And that sounds like what you're trying to do is kind of, you know, and it's, you're trading it for another set of skills. You're trading it for being able to run the CNC and do them on there. But just, you know, assuming that you've developed those skills, then you're basically trading those skills for the mundane lesser skill level stuff where you can get those taken care of with a machine and then you can do the higher level activities, you know, that the machine doesn't do or whatever.
So. Yeah. And, you know, I don't know if I'll, you know, hog out some of the bevels on the machine and not like, you know, just try to take out material and not necessarily, you know, try to do bevels on the machine. I don't think I'll be going quite that far yet. Still trying to, you know, make it more of a, you know, I don't know. I don't want to, my biggest thing, I think my biggest hang up that I'm afraid of doing at this point is I've spent, you know, 5 years now and more than that, actually trying to build up these skills of being able to make a knife with my hands. And I have that skill and it's something I am very afraid of losing. Now in a business sense, that doesn't make sense, but on a esoteric, self-fulfilling, whatever sort of side, that's one of the things that scares me about sort of going full production.
It's a trade-off. I mean, to a certain extent, I mean, at least for a while, I mean, it's somewhat of a trade-off of, you know, you don't completely, you know, like I think I would be way slower than I used to be. And I probably would end up messing some stuff up and having to redo it. But I think I could still, you know, build one just from raw materials and a bandsaw and drill press and all that good stuff. But, you know, I definitely don't have the amount of skill to just hop over there and do that as I used to. So,
especially with like grinding blades, that's one of those things that even, you know, if I go a week or two without grinding a blade, I can tell.
Yeah.
And so like that's one of those things that, you know, if you don't use that skill, it sort of diminishes over time. I mean, you can get back up on the bike and figure it out and remember how to do it, but it's, I don't know. That's one of the things I think that's holding me up in between the ears more so than anything.
Yeah. Well, but yeah, like I said, you could do basically everything you're talking about other than just, you know, still do the blade grinds by hand and then, you know, but just have more parts flow. And I think that would totally work to increase your output the way you're talking about while still kind of maintaining very close proximity to the end product of what you're putting out now.
Yeah.
Like, I think you could come up with a product that would be almost identical, you know, unless you intentionally, like you want to start doing like milling patterns and stuff like that, that you can't do now.
Yeah.
You know, like on handles and stuff, but like, you know, if you chose to make a knife that's exactly like what you're making now, but you incorporated a CNC the way you're talking about doing, then I think that you could put the two sides side by side and wouldn't tell much difference, you know, to the untrained eye. So,
yeah,
you know, I think that's totally doable.
So, yeah, that's sort of my plan at the moment. Okay. Did you want to sort of answer that question yourself? Like, what your plan is for the next 5 years?
Yeah, I can pretty quickly, and then let you do your. I'm assuming you said you have another actual question for me, right?
Yeah, I got one.
Okay, so yeah, for me, kind of the same. Like, I don't have an exact. I probably should. I don't have like an exact number or whatever, but basically, I just want to continue down the path that we're going, but be, you know, considerably bigger. I want to have. I would say within 5 years, I would like to be able to have probably at least triple the amount of employees that we've got right now, which would put us well into the double digits at that point. Yeah. And be, we will for sure probably be expanded into a second building at that point. At least we're already actually talking about, we haven't gotten serious about exactly what size we want to do and all that, but we're already talking about adding a second building. So,
nice.
So yeah, I want to, you know, well, like I said, we've got another machine. It's getting to the point where it's going to start to get pretty crowded if we keep everything under one roof like this. So,
yeah,
and if we clear out.
In 2021, it was me, you, and Luke before we moved into the new shop. How many employees do you have now?
We have six now, not counting me and Amy.
Okay. But,
I mean, technically Amy's a full-time employee too that was not there then, so that's seven. And then, I mean, I was so obviously already doing full-time.
You've basically already tripled, you know, from what, you know.
Right.
You had then, so, I mean, yeah, I mean, that was 4 years
within
ago.
Within the last 5 years, yeah.
Yeah.
So I think that's reasonable to think that we'd at least probably triple in the next – within the next 5 years.
Yeah.
But yeah, so a different building, moving in, we want to move our office, basically all the non-machining stuff, like all the non-dirty stuff, our office, all the shipping stuff, the laser, all that stuff over into another building.
Yeah.
And so that we can just continue to fill this one up with machines, because it's by the time that next machine gets in here, it's going to start to get a little bit crowded. So,
yeah. Do you plan on moving assembly to the new, or would that all be?
For a long time, that's what I wanted to do, but honestly, it depends.
Yeah.
If we get to the point like I'm trying to get to, where assembly is more just pure assembly,
yeah,
and they're not constantly running back and forth. Like, if I can get, I'm currently trying to get things tweaked to where we can start cutting locks with the machines and stuff instead of having to do it the way we currently do it.
Yeah.
The way we currently do it, they're having to run back and forth to the grinder and stuff to fit stuff up too much that it doesn't make sense to have it in a separate building.
Yeah.
But if I can get it to the point where everything can get done, you know, machining wise, and then we're literally just assembling, you know, or maybe just tweaking, fine tuning just the detent or something like that at the assembly desk, then yes, I would kind of like to move that over there. So it's in a clean area, you know, separate from all the machines, and that also would free us up a little bit of space for machines and stuff. So
yeah, well, maybe able to move it if, you know, you move y'all's office to the other building, might be able to have like an assembly room possibly. But yeah
that actually is a good thought. That's for sure possible. That way at least kind of keeps it a little bit cleaner and stuff. So
yeah,
keep it enclosed. So yeah, more employees, more machines, another, at least one more building. I'm going to trying to plan this one out and build it. I don't want to do it too soon and not be able to afford to build it as big as I'd like to build it, so that we have plenty of room to grow. But at the same time, I don't want to wait too long either. So
yeah, don't want to be doing the, you know, shuffle in between everybody.
Right.
Like we were doing.
I don't want to reach a point where it's hurting our productivity because we're so crowded.
Yeah.
You know, I'd like to get spread it out before then. I also want to have a little, not that this makes a lot of difference one way or the other with us being out here in the middle of nowhere where we're at, but I want to have a small little lobby, you know, area in the new building with like a little display area or whatever. And
I have a very strong desire to have like a little lobby with like, a, you know, even at my level, I want to do that. And there's no reason for me to do that, but I want to have a little lobby with all the models and some cool stuff hung around.
It's cool. It makes some good place to get, you know, shoot cool content and stuff like that. And then, you know, we do have visitors semi-regularly. Sometimes, you know, actual knife people that make a trip or whatever and come, but also, you know, we have locals that just pop in that, you know, I heard there was a knife shop here. I just wanted to see what y'all do, whatever. And like, which is fine, but we don't need people just walking into the shop like that. You know what I mean? Like into the machines and all that stuff. So, which is currently what happens. And so we do that. We'll put a sign on the door or whatever, and we'll probably keep the door to the machine shop locked. Yeah. And then that way it'll, if somebody is going to come up and just pop in, they'll at least pop into an actual formal lobby and not be just up in the middle of everything.
Yeah.
So, that's, like I said, I don't have an exact, like, I can't tell you exactly how many knives I want to be producing. I know I do want to have this will, hopefully it's going to expand quite a bit between now and then, but starting very soon, I want an expanded lineup of products. Like I want more models. I want more variety. I'm really kind of hyper focused on that right now, trying to get us more variety and stuff, more offerings that we can put out there. So that's a big thing, especially over the next 5 years, just to build up a bigger catalog of products and stuff. So, that's cool. Kind of what I'm envisioning.
Yeah, that's sort of what I was expecting, but yeah, it's, you know, good to hear some of the, you know, actual thoughts. And I didn't know you were planning on a new building at any point. Or, I mean, I knew you at some point you would want a new building, but you
know, right.
I didn't know it was already possibly on the horizon.
Yeah, I could be wrong, but I got a feeling probably no later than next year we'll at least be started on it, if not full on building it. So,
sweet. All right. So I also had a question for you that I don't know if I've ever asked you sort of directly, or, you know, I don't know if I've asked you on the podcast, or I don't think I've ever asked you on the podcast. I'm not sure if I've ever, you know, put it quite like this, but when did you decide or think, you know, that you wanted to go into the production side of knife making instead of sort of staying in the custom realm?
When did I kind of flip that switch?
Yeah.
So it was right around the time to when I really like actually made my mind up. I would say it was actually right about the time we met. It was honestly, it I feel like I was
burning hot at that point. So I wasn't sure.
At the risk of sounding a little, you know, woo-hoo, whatever, hippie crazy. Like I really kind of feel like that, like you came along, like that was kind of like I was being looked out for that, like, hey, you're wanting to do this. And, you know, one of my big issues with doing that was like, where do I find employees? Well, what, you know, how do I even go about beginning to get somebody to help me or whatever?
Yeah.
And, you know, then you just popped up out of the blue. So,
fell out of the stars.
Yep. Just fell out of the stars. The stars aligned and there was Chase. So, and like we've talked about before, you know, we've told the story before, but that, you know, started off just kind of helping do some of the, you know, some of the work we were talking about that you may eliminate with your CNC or whatever. You know, you started helping me with some of the just kind of the grunt work and stuff and to speed me up on my custom stuff. But then pretty quickly, I think pretty much right off the bat, we were setting things in motion, but it took a little bit to get everything rolling.
Yeah.
We started getting the parts done by the OEM shop. I always have to qualify that because I don't, you know how people are. So a US OEM shop. And then, you know, you were the production side of things and I was still building customs and Luke was doing everything in between, shipping stuff and doing the laser work on for both sides of the thing and all that. So, and I think you kind of already know this, but I will say what led up to it. So I went for years. I was totally happy with what I was doing. I always admired what the other guys were doing that had built into production companies like Emerson and Hinderer, Strider, all these guys that had, you know, started out as custom makers, and, you know, some of the other, if you go back far enough in history, I'm sure you see some of that with some of the big companies like, you know, Benchmade and whatever, but like, they're so big at this point that I didn't really relate to them and their story as much, you know. Yeah. It was the guys that I could see, you know, especially some of them that I had seen grow, you know, from a smaller production company into a bigger production company. I didn't necessarily see their full transition from custom to production, but I did get to see them grow as production companies as I was coming up. So it, you know, I always admired that. And I think deep down I wanted to be able to do that, but I don't think I had the confidence or whatever to believe that I could do that. Like, it was like kind of like a pipe dream kind of thing. And yeah, I didn't get serious about, okay, I could actually do this. And then I got to credit Amy, which is true of most good things that I've done in my life, that she gets credit for at the very least prompting me, if not, if not almost all the credit. But I never listened to podcasts and stuff before this. So then she got me listening to a Dave Ramsey podcast, and just about, you know, how his stuff is, financial stuff in general started. And I was reaching an age where, you know, I was paying more attention to like financial stuff and all, like, hey, we get, at some point I'm going to be retiring and so on and so forth or whatever, you know, or I'm going to be getting older. I'm going to need to have some money put away. So started paying attention to that. And then that led to listening to other podcasts. And then led to one in particular, which was at the time called the MF CEO podcast, Andy Frisella. He's been a huge impact on everything to do with, I mean, whole life in general, but especially on this side of things. It was a lot of business content, self-improvement kind of stuff, you know, and honestly, it kind of gave me the confidence to be like, okay, well, you know, I could do this too. Like, there's no reason I can't do this. Like, if other people have done it, then it's doable. And so it just was kind of a slow burn to get my confidence to the point where, I could take it to another level, you know, that I felt like, and we've talked about in the past where I felt like I had to pay my dues. That was certainly part of it. I felt like I had to reach a point where, you know, I had been making knives long enough and had enough of a following built up, enough of a reputation built up, that it made sense to, you know, just kind of a natural progression to move into production stuff versus just some guy that nobody's heard of. Hey, I want to have a production knife company. And people do it. That's certainly doable too, because plenty of people at this point have done it. But in my mind, that was not the route to take or whatever. Plus, I had too much, you know, craftsman in me or whatever that I wanted to be able to have that artistic expression still too, not just build a company.
Yeah.
So anyway, that's kind of how that transition got started. Some little prompting from Amy, listening to some podcasts, a lot of prompting and learning and opening my mind up from there, and reading some books that went along with that. And then, like I said, good timing with you coming along. I felt like I was kind of, you know,
star child.
Yeah. Star child, the stars aligned and, you know, things. And honestly, I feel like ever since that's been the way it's been too. Like just things kind of like align. You know, there's been times when I've forced the issue and I thought they were aligning, and turns out not so much, but
you're,
I think I probably
still,
I still probably lessons that I needed to learn. You know, and that's probably why it happened.
It happened, you know, for a reason that, you know,
probably,
you know, you probably wanted it to be at a little different time than it was happening, but, you know, I think it's one of those things you kind of have to learn when trying to build a machine like you're building.
Yeah. You have to, you know, it's with anything you're building like this, you've got to pay your tuition. You know, I didn't go to school, to business school or machining school or whatever. Like, you, if you're going to learn something, you're going to pay a tuition somewhere, whether it be at a formal school or whether it be in the mistakes you make along the way. And I've definitely paid a lot of tuition along the way on both sides of it, on the business side and the actual technical side of stuff. So, So I think that was a good idea, and we're starting to run a little bit long. So I think we can give ourselves time, and next week we'll throw this in as a segment as well. So we can, like I said, hone our interview skills here a little bit.
Yeah.
that sounds good to you.
Yeah, sounds like a plan. I enjoyed kind of hearing, you know, I thought I knew some of the pieces, but yeah, like I wasn't sure of the exact sort of timing and, you know, all that went into it and when you sort of flipped that switch. So it was cool to hear about that.
Yeah, likewise. I like hearing, you know, especially since I kind of, you know, have a little bit of a vested interest in seeing where your future goes. So I like hearing the plans on it. So that's good.
For sure. Yeah. I think my biggest hurdle at this point is I'm not one to borrow or, you know, borrow money in sort of a lot of ways. The only thing I owe money on right now is my house. And I think I need to kind of get over that at some point to be able to.
Well, I can tell you if you're going to run a business, you got to be smart about it now.
Yeah. I think I'm hamstringing myself at this point more than anything else by not having some sort of extraneous cash flow to be able to advance, you know, machinery or, you know, improvements that need to be made and stuff like that. But
yeah, anyway. Yeah. Sometimes you got to, depending on how you look at it, if you look at taking on a little bit of debt as a step back, then you got to look at it as you're taking a step back to take 3 or 4 steps forward or more, even some cases. Yeah. So it's it's extremely hard to do when you're talking about equipment that costs what CNCs cost, stuff like that. That's, you know, and what you've got to look at is, okay, yeah, I'm going to go into debt for a few years and have to make payments on this thing. But if you don't do it, how much money are you leaving on the table that you could make in those 4 or 5 years or whatever until it's paid off, you know, because you don't have it.
Yeah.
And assuming everything goes relatively smoothly, then that equation, if you could actually put numbers to it, would be like, it'd be a no brainer.
Yeah.
So
just one of those mental hurdles I've always had
on there or not.
Do what?
I was saying that's something we can talk about more either on here or off air even. So
yeah, probably.
So all right, guys. We need questions, we need suggestions, and we need some stories. Don't let Mr. John Bidwell be the only one.
Yes. Yeah. Please send them to knifefreakshow@gmail.com with 1 S. That's knifefreakshow@gmail.com. Like Jonathan said, send us your questions, send us suggestions for shows or for guests, send us your stories. We want to hear them because that's what this thing's all about is, you know, making memories basically. So
that's right. And this is the Knife Freak Show, not just the Jonathan and Chase show. So
yes,
all those knife freaks out there, we want you to be a part of it. So, and we do, on that note, we greatly appreciate you guys. Like, it still kind of boggles my mind that as many people as do like get on here and listen to us and watch us ramble every week. So, so we greatly appreciate it.
Yes. Thank y'all all very much. You got anything else?
Nope. I think we're good. We'll see you guys next week.
And let your freak flag fly.